So, where have all the generals gone, and can we expect a military coup in the next fortnight? Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company Conductor. I had hoped to record a podcast which was nothing to do with Prigozhin and his mutiny, and in a way this is, in a way it isn't. Certainly it's triggered by the fallout. Now, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that 13 senior officers have been detained for investigation, brackets interrogation, close brackets, of whom some, but by no means all, have since been released. And we've also heard from them that 15 various senior officers have been fired or suspended. Now, look, it's very difficult to know quite what's going on in this context, whether in fact this is all true. After all, our main data point really here is the fate of the head of the aerospace forces, Colonel General Sergei Surovikin. No, hang on, I'm sorry. Full army general. And I just realised that actually I apologised to Surovikin, but there you go. Anyway, army general Sergei Surovikin, who apparently had prior notice of the mutiny, and as a result has been not seen for quite some time. Now, even there, I mean, we have to have some cautions. Did he actually have specific prior notice of the mutiny and chose to say nothing? Or was it that he was in some boozy late-night bullshit session at which people said, look, you know, we're not going to stand for this, and he didn't then report, quite understandably, that as a kind of specific harbinger? Who knows? The interesting thing is, and I'll come on to this later, is we can't forget that Surovikin was one of the real high flyers of the Russian military, the top seed for succeeding General Gerasimov as chief of the general staff. And in hindsight, one wonders if that actually put an extra target on his back, given the degree to which Gerasimov seems to be particularly behind a lot of these current, shall we say, mishaps for people who seem to be otherwise potential successors to him. But anyway, Surovikin, it would be extraordinary if he was not returned to service in due course. It really would be a serious act of self-harm. But then again, how many other serious acts of self-harm have we seen from this regime? But nonetheless, it could be that he's just currently being rested and rusticated, and again, the cynic in me wonders, they're waiting for the bruises on his face to heal before he can be paraded in front of the cameras. So we shall see what happens. But the very fact that Surovikin has been out of circulation for so long, all we've seen is his deputy, suggests precisely that there is some kind of serious inquest and inquisition going on behind the scenes. And indeed, it also looks like there could well be an attempt to undermine Surovikin indirectly as well by damaging his power base. It's worth noting that although no one else really seemed to have been that keen to try and stop Wagner, it was the Air Force that actually did and suffered the deaths of 13 pilots as a result. And yet we have Surovikin's deputy, Colonel General Andrei Yudin, apparently in detention, and also Major General Nikolai Gostov, the commander of the 4th Air Force Army, also seems recently and unexpectedly to have been sacked. So the irony of the situation is precisely, it doesn't matter if the Air Force did its job during the mutiny, nonetheless the concerns over Surovikin are clearly sufficiently toxic as to be contagious, but more to the point, if you're seen as part of Surovikin's team, shall we say, you become vulnerable just simply as in the process of making sure that your boss becomes vulnerable. Such, unfortunately, are the realities of Russian military politics. And we saw this most strikingly in a different way, nothing to do with the mutiny directly at least, but with the suspension dismissal of Major General Ivan Popov, head of the 58th Army, which is currently essentially holding the line along the crucial southern Zaporizhian front in Ukraine. And essentially what seems to have happened was that he complained to, well, up the chain of command, which basically means to Gerasimov, with his dual hat as both Chief of the General Staff and overall field commander in Ukraine, about the fact that not only did he feel that there wasn't enough artillery fire support being provided, but also more generally that he felt he absolutely needed to rotate more of his forces, that he had troops who had been in tough fighting for too long, they were losing their edge. You do need in those circumstances to rotate, give them a chance to regroup and move other forces in. And apparently that was refused, and he got angry, and he threatened to take his concerns up the chain of command, which essentially means to the commander-in-chief, in other words, to Putin. And that's when two interesting things happened, one that we absolutely know, and one that there's a certain amount of inference about. The inference thing is that just before things all went public, a Ukrainian attack using a British-supplied Storm Shadow cruise missile slammed into the hotel in Berdyansk, at which Popov usually stays. Now, he happened not to be there that night, but there is a certain suspicion circulating, certainly in the sort of Russian Z-blogger social media sphere, that actually his location was leaked to the Ukrainians in the hope that they would do someone else's dirty work for them. Well, we don't know if it's true. I raise it, A, because it's just an interesting anecdote, and B, because, in all honesty, I can't totally rule it out. I don't know the honest answer, but as I say, it's not something that I would actually assume automatically is not the case. What was interesting then is that Popov did not actually go public. In some ways, what happened was it indirectly went public. And that is that he sent a message to a parliamentarian who in due course put it out on social media, and therefore it went public. And this was a really scathing assessment of what was going on. I mean, he talked about, I mentioned, a lack of counter-battery fires, poor artillery reconnaissance and the like. But then, after, as a result, he was sacked from his or removed from his position, he then went on and actually sort of made a much more passionate and personal message, in which, crucially, I mean, he said, look, the armed forces of Ukraine could not break through our army from the front. Our senior commander hit us from the rear, treacherously and vilely decapitating the army at the most difficult and tense moment. And interestingly, in case of any ambiguity, when he talks about commander, he was clearly talking about Gerasimov, because at another point he talks about how the commander ensured that orders were signed by the Minister of Defence. So although he's implicating Shoigu by extension, in some ways he regards the main villain of the piece, the main instigator, clearly as Gerasimov. Now, Popov was not exactly a household name, but he was commander of the 58th Army, which, you know, is a very serious position. He was, you know, clearly someone who was destined for higher things. He also had an unusually good reputation amongst his troops for actually giving a damn about them. I mean, I have no idea if he also embezzles and such like. I think to a degree, one assumes that everyone has some kind of perks in the Russian system from their position. But nonetheless, again, no particular scandals have surrounded him. And as I said, I mean, the way he speaks, even, I mean, his military call sign was Spartak, Spartacus. And he referred very sort of affectionately and warmly to his own soldiers as my gladiators. You know, again, there wasn't quite this haughty chain of command, military aristocracy monkey that one sometimes gets within the Russian military, that is very, very reminiscent of the absolute worst of the Soviet era. So anyway, what we have is a high flyer who has been withdrawn from a position in which he clearly was doing a good job. 58th Army is doing an unexpectedly effective job in holding back the Ukrainian counteroffensive. The interesting thing is this is actually part of a pattern. And the pattern suggests that Popov might in due course return, though I think the way that his critiques have become public implies not. But if one could look, for example, at the fate of Colonel General Mikhail Cheplinsky, hero of the Russian Federation, a very well-regarded paratroop commander. He fought in both the First and the Second Chechen Wars. And by 2022, he had risen to become overall commander of the VDV, Russian Airborne Assault Forces. On the other hand, the paratroopers have always been in some ways a bit of a thorn in the side, some would say pain in the arse, for the military hierarchs. And this goes back to, frankly, Soviet times, where there's always a slight sort of antagonism there, because the paratroopers, well, they think they're special. But more to the point, they have a very different culture. It tends to be a rather flatter military culture. Again, the officers are not quite so distant from the men. I mean, one can almost think of a sort of a gradation. The regular army, the paratroopers, the Spetsnaz. And, you know, as you go along that, there's much, much less of this gap between officers and men, senior officers and junior ones, and so forth. So, you know, Cheplinsky was not just able at his job, but also regarded as much, much closer to the men on the ground. He was also, again, another potential candidate to become, in due course, Chief of the General Staff, especially, obviously, if Surovikin is no longer in the running. But the point is that, really, as a result of behind-the-scenes machinations and his own critiques of what had been happening, and particularly his refusal to continue to allow the military commanders to basically waste his troops. I mean, paratroopers are clearly generally going to be tough, well-trained, willing to show initiative and the like. But the point is, increasingly we found, just like the Spetsnaz, that they were essentially just being thrown into the attack as light infantry, often suffering exceedingly heavy casualties because they were being put in the kind of positions for which they're not trained and equipped. It's a waste. And it's a waste just simply because the paras were at least actually willing to go in and fight. Anyway, Cheplinsky was basically saying, don't use my boys as cannon fodder, and he had to pay the price. In January, he was in disgrace. But then, in April of this year, he was back in sight. He was deputy field commander. And, you know, again, there was an element in which the realities of the war, the need to actually have good officers, replaced the need to have two totally compliant ones, especially when you also have a regular toll of generals being killed in one form or another. I mean, most recently we had Lieutenant General Oleg Tsokov, deputy commander of the Southern Military District, being killed in a Ukrainian missile attack. So in those circumstances, although it's always a parallel of which to beware, even though I think I'll probably come to it in the second part of this podcast, but nonetheless, there is a certain resonance with what actually happened with the Stalinist Red Army. Remember, there were these astonishingly brutal purges of the High Command in the period 36 to 38, in which many of the best and the brightest ended up being removed from office if they were lucky, shot if not. And from Stalin's point of view, it was most important that he had a compliant officer corps. Remember, the purge of the military took part as part of a sort of systemic taming of the whole Soviet system. You know, it was almost one could chart it as Putin's, there you go, there's a Freudian slip, Stalin's interrogators and executioners worked their way through one institution, one sector of the Soviet system to the next, eliminating anyone who could potentially pose some kind of a threat to Stalin and the power of the system. Anyway, so that seemed to be the priority, that basically political security took precedence over professionalism and capacity. And then came the war. And in the sudden and desperate existential, and it was truly an existential struggle, not like this war, despite how Putin tries to sort of spin this as Great Patriotic War 2.0, or maybe Great Patriotic Special Military Operation. Nonetheless, what we saw is how quickly Stalin appreciated the different needs. And not only did he withdraw himself from trying to micromanage the conflict, it's a lesson that Putin hasn't learned, But also, we saw the astonishing spectacle of, you know, highly regarded military officers who had then been dispatched to the Gulag labor camps being summoned back and given office again. You know, people like Konstantin Rokossovsky, Polish-born, but then joined the Red Guard, the Red Army, distinguished himself in the Civil War and such like. Anyway, he was swept up in the purges. He went to the Gulag, his family into internal exile. He experienced two mock executions. He had fingernails torn out. He had broken ribs. And then one day he summoned to the office of the head of the camp and essentially is told, well, your motherland needs you. He's presented with his uniform, which of course, you know, hangs like a shroud over his emaciated body, given that he has been in a Gulag camp. And he's reappointed into the Red Army, first as a colonel, then rising as a general, serving throughout the war. And after the war, indeed, will become, following the Stalinist takeover of Poland, the Polish Minister of Defence. So, you know, you do have these figures who can actually recover. And no, of course, Putin's system is not the Stalinist system. And, you know, in some ways, the Putin system is, I say, Stalinism ultra-light in this respect, in that, you know, Chaplinsky or indeed Popov did not face having their fingernails torn out, but likely they're also unlikely to have quite perhaps such a rapid and amazingly vertiginous return to favour. But still, I mean, I think the point is, one has to think about this, why is the regime having to firstly dismiss and suspend and investigate its own officers? And then what does this actually mean for the regime and perhaps even for the prospects of the war? And you know what? I'll talk about those questions after the break. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counter-terrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/InMoscowShadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. Now, before I start, let me just sort of flag up a couple of warnings, a couple of, you know, analytic pathologies of which we should beware. First of all, is that very, very human temptation to find patterns where patterns may not actually exist. To assume that if Y follows X, then somehow X caused Y. It's not always the case. I mean, for example, I'm not convinced that Popov's fate has anything really to do with the mutiny and the heightened concerns. It might have slightly left people like Gerasimov that much more antsy, that much more concerned about stepping hard and quickly on any challenges, but we shouldn't actually go beyond that. The second is also beware the convenient retrospective reputation building. I mean, I can't help but notice that every time someone gets dismissed or rotated out of a key position, there will be people claiming that this was an especially well-regarded soldier, particularly popular with the troops, whatever else. It's not always the case. I mean, yes, Popov does seem to have been, and I think one could say that Chaplinsky also, Surovikin exceedingly able, though I wouldn't say a popular choice, not with the troops on the ground, certainly. But other times, no, actually, these people aren't. They're just, you know, just one other Russian general. No worse, no better, no more able, no less than others. So, you know, it's because in some ways we have a tendency to think, well, there has to be a good reason. And for many of us, we want to see this as an example of the Putin regime devouring its best and its brightest, that we automatically assume that everyone it devours must be best and brightest. We have to be aware of that, at least, and try and kind of push against it. So, what actually is going on? What's happening with all these various inquisitions and interrogations? Well, look, I mean, there is an element in which the regime is, and here I'll seem to be going back on myself, devouring its best and its brightest. And again, there's a particular parallel. I mean, if we think of, for example, Stalin, you know, one of the many victims of his purges was Marshal Mikhail Tukhachevsky, who had been dubbed the Red Napoleon, who was shot in 1937. You know, truly outstanding figure, whose writings, especially about deep battle, you know, the capacity to use mechanized warfare and aircraft, air power, to strike deep into, through and behind the enemy lines, very much a kind of Soviet blitzkrieg take, were well ahead of their time, still have relevance today, and frankly could have been exceedingly useful for the Red Army if they had been properly thought through and integrated. But no, precisely because he was popular, he was willful, he was thus dangerous, and that's why he had to go. So why today? Why is it being done today? Because, you know, whatever else one can say, look, Putin certainly himself does not, I think, see any kind of real threat from the military. Well, the first reason is the tall poppy syndrome. Precisely the ones that are going are standing out, and they are not a threat to Putin, but they are a threat to perhaps Shoigu, but certainly Gerasimov. I think this is one of the interesting things that does seem to be coming out of more recent revelations, is the degree to which it is Gerasimov himself, the chief of the general staff, and a man who, quite frankly, I mean, he's been chief of the general staff longer than any other figure in post-Soviet times. Before the war, it looked as if he was getting ready to be retired and move on. He was beginning to acquire those kind of honorific positions that tend to be the sort of the bridge between your most senior position and retirement, at least in the Russian military. But nonetheless, he is now chief of the general staff, and I suspect he probably does feel a bit of a fraud, maybe, perhaps seeing his best days well behind him. I mean, let's be honest, whatever else he has done, he will now go down in Wikipedia and the history books first and foremost for presiding over this catastrophic conflict. And I think in these circumstances, it may well be that he has that much less tolerance for anyone who seems able and pushy around him, and that much more willing to ensure that, remember, in most cases, it's not that they actually get sacked or disappeared or anything like that. No, I mean, they just tend to get just rotated to other positions that are less visible, less career building, shall we say. So that's the first thing. I mean, the best go because they are the most dangerous in that respect. But also, I think it's fair to say that there is a correlation between the best commanders and those who do tend to be closer to their own units, or at the very least understand that they need to defend them. I mean, that's the firstly, it's the responsibility of the commander, but secondly, precisely that's the kind of thing that builds coherence within a unit, and are willing and able to speak up, precisely to complain when they feel that the campaign is not being fought properly, or when they feel that the units under their command are not being treated right. And these are the kind of things that make you both visible and dangerous. And here's a good point, actually, to mention another military commander, another paratrooper, in fact, whose fate has, again, at the moment, slightly unclear. We're relying here to a large extent on, again, some of these Z-blogger social media channels. But anyway, the allegation is that Major General Vladimir Seliverstov, the commander of the Airborne's 106th Division, has also been removed from office. We don't really know much more detail than that. Seliverstov, again, reputation as a hard-driving commander, which is what you tend to find within the paratroopers. He was visible at Bakhmut, which is where actually the paratroopers seem to be picking up a certain amount of the slack that was left by the withdrawal of Wagner. And although, technically speaking, he reports to Cheplinsky, there's not really much of a suggestion that it was Cheplinsky who had him removed, which suggests further up the chain of command, and there isn't that much further up the chain of command. In other words, there is just Gerasimov. The thing about Seliverstov, although some people have tried to suggest that it's to do with more arcane political manoeuvres, particularly that he was in some ways connected to Alexei Dumin, the governor of Tula, to a large extent, again, it does seem to be that he's another one of these commanders who felt that it was his time to speak up. It was his time, admittedly rather more successfully behind the scenes than Popov, but nonetheless to assert the interests of his men and his concerns about the overall direction of the campaign, and that could not be allowed. But we'll have to wait and see. But nonetheless, there's another general to watch, Major General Vladimir Siliverstov. We will see if he pops up back in his current position, whether he's rotated somewhere else, or whether he's going to be another one of the victims of this current sort of small-scale and quiet purge. Now, it does not mean, again, I suppose this is another one of the analytic problems that we have to be aware of. It does not mean just because the people who speak out, and therefore the people who suffer, tend to be the most competent, that everyone else is incompetent. There are, we have to recognise, a fair number of actually perfectly good, and I'm talking about this in the professional rather than necessarily moral sense, but perfectly good general-level Russian officers who also accept and understand the politics of the situation. They are doing their best. They are, in some ways, like so many of the technocrats within the civilian government. They may not be happy with what's going on. They may think that, in fact, other policies would be much, much more effective. But they're also aware of the limits of what they think they can change. They have come to terms with it and accepted it. And so they'll just do their best in difficult circumstances. But that, all that said, I think there is another reason for the churn, shall we say, at the level of the general officers. And, I mean, we are seeing it on a lesser level, but there's a little bit of this also at the level of colonels. And I think the reason for that is precisely because Putin still cannot bring himself to do anything about Defense Minister Shoigu and Chief of the General Staff Gerasimov. And therefore, in some ways, you are having to let them defend themselves, and you're having to push back against those who would undermine them. Not because you necessarily want to, but because you feel you have to. Why is Putin still stuck with Shoigu and Gerasimov, given that whatever they may have been able to do in the past, they clearly are not doing a great job at the moment, both in terms of actually fighting the war? I mean, it's going okay at the moment in terms of weathering the counteroffensive, we have to recognise. But it's still very much on a knife edge. I think the possibilities that the Ukrainians will still be able to punch through somewhere, at least, on the main battle line is by no means something that we can rule out. So, you know, this is not exactly the greatest accolade for them. And at the same time, you know, it has become painfully obvious just how deeply unpopular they are with both the officer corps and the rank and file. So in many ways, you would think it would actually make good sense to be rid of them. But first of all, as I've mentioned before, the Prigozhin factor. To do it now, after Prigozhin was, you know, in effect willing to launch a mutiny in the name of getting rid of them, would look either as if Putin was caving to Prigozhin, and there's reasons enough and people who are suggesting that anyway, so I don't think he wants to add fuel to that particular fire, but it would also actually suggest that in some ways the mutiny was right, and it becomes harder and harder to basically defend your position when you actually have to acknowledge that its fundamental point, the point in which actually sort of Prigozhin at least officially hung the whole event on, was justified. The second reason why Putin's not willing to do this is precisely it is disruptive. I mean, we've seen this generally, that Putin does not like to reshuffle his top team if he can possibly avoid it, and especially his security people at a time when he's in the middle of, well, yes, a war or a special military operation. In that context, you know, because if you get rid of Shoigu and Gerasimov, you then have to decide who's going to be the next chief of the general staff. Oh gosh, look, your primary candidate Surovikin is currently, you know, out of sight and quite possibly out of favour. Chief of the General Staff really is a position that an incoming Minister of Defence would probably expect to, if not pick, at least have a very significant role in choosing who's going to be the next Minister of Defence. It's not even just simply a question of who you're willing to give the job to, but would someone really be willing to actually accept that job? You know, if you have higher ambitions, you might regard that as something of a poison chalice. So there might be a position in which actually you have someone who's essentially forced into that job. So for all these kind of reasons, you know, it would not necessarily be a happy time. It would certainly involve disruption. And thirdly, and perhaps at least as important as the others, you lose your excuse, your alibi. Remember, Shoigu in particular, I mean, his role has increasingly been to be Putin's flak vest, to be the person who takes all the incoming fire so as to protect the commander-in-chief, in other words, Putin himself. If you, especially at the moment when, you know, the counteroffensive still is rolling and has definitely not culminated and there's still possibilities, if you replace Shoigu and Gerasimov, you bring someone else in and things don't get any better, or indeed actually get worse, as is entirely possible, it becomes harder and harder to always blame it on your representatives. So I think this is it. It's that sense of, is he willing to play this card? The scapegoat card is one that can only be played once, really. And in those circumstances, I think Putin, as ever, timid, unsure, not wanting to make a tough decision when he's not certain of the outcome, is still sticking with the devils he knows, because there is always that sense of things could get even worse, and it might be even more necessary some way down the line to actually have to jettison them as a one-shot political gambit in order to avoid any kind of blame. Of course, a lot of this leads to the inevitable overheated Western consideration of whether there's going to be a military coup. I don't see anything of the sort happening, at least not yet. I think that there's no real signs, first of all, of a kind of coherent critique of the war, but, you know, beyond in some cases that Shoigu and Gerasimov must go. But in terms of a wider kind of political critique, let alone something around whom we're beginning to see a coherence of some kind of cabal, the emergence of leaders willing and able to actually pull something together, I'm not yet seeing that. I mean, again, if we look at the kind of classic African or Latin American models, often these are coups of the colonels. In other words, it's not the generals who are already compromised, but the colonels. And in this context, actually, ironically enough, the fact that the military, such a huge proportion of the operational force, is currently deployed in or right next to Ukraine, actually acts as a source of security for Putin. I mean, to put it bluntly, these days the majority of men with guns in Moscow are not military. They are National Guard, they are police, they are FSB, they are Federal Protection Service. So actually it would be quite difficult, even just in practical terms, to launch a coup, even if you're able to avoid the informants of the FSB's military counterintelligence division and such like, and get some kind of a cabal together. But what I could see, again, at some point in the future, I really would want to stress that we're talking about a trend rather than some kind of imminent prediction, but the military as part of some kind of a coalition, which is what precisely we saw, for example, when Khrushchev was eventually ousted. That the military were actually quite significant, not least in their planes flying in representatives to the Central Committee to oust Putin. My God, can I just not actually avoid these slips? Apparently not. To oust Khrushchev. But the point is, they were not a crucial instigator. They operated within the context of essentially a politician-led coalition. Now look, these kind of political coups are much, much harder when you don't have a Communist Party, a Central Committee, a set of rules and so forth that makes it a sort of very clear pathway to toppling a leader. And if we're going to have a parallel, it would much more be the so-called February Revolution in 1917, in which the Tsar is just basically told that it's time to go by a collection of politicians and generals. But again, I think so we would see the military as part of that coalition, or may simply be that, just as with the mutiny, it's not that they would necessarily be prime movers, but that they would do nothing to protect Putin. They will be happy to sit back and see him topple. So I think this is it. We know if we're talking about this in the long term, and I need to keep stressing that, the long term could be months or it could be years or it could be never. But nonetheless, I think we are clearly seeing the emergence of increasing anger or dissatisfaction within the military. Given that Putin cannot give them the one thing that will probably, at least even in the short term, be a kind of crowd-pleasing sop to their concerns, which is to remove Shoigu and Gerasimov and put in higher regarded figures in their place. I think it's important. I mean, a lot would depend on precisely who gets to replace them. In that context, you know, we are not seeing the imminence of direct resistance to the state, but what we are seeing is disaffection and disenchantment, and that carries with it the implication that at some point in the future they will be willing to listen to other people with other ideas. So that's something to watch. Final point is, what does this actually mean for the war? Does it actually mean that the military is disunited and therefore will not fight as well in Ukraine? Well, honestly, my answer is not necessarily. Again, the situation is perversely that the war is in this respect a benefit for the Kremlin. If you are stuck in the middle of the war, you are rather busy. You're not necessarily thinking about alternative political futures. Instead, you are basically busy dealing with the day-to-day necessities of, gosh, well, staying alive. People are busy. And even someone like Popov, I mean, he was not setting out to be in any way some kind of a political rival or challenge. He was just, as he felt it, raising very necessary critiques so that something could be done. And I think that is a crucial thing. It's a long-term ill. It is the fact of it undermines the Russians' capacity to learn the necessary lessons of the war if people begin to start thinking that if they raise problems, instead of leading to solutions, it will instead lead to scapegoating. So I think this is part of the reasons why the Russians aren't doing particularly well in this war. I mean, we have to acknowledge that they've learned some lessons, but they tend to learn them slowly and painfully, certainly much, much more slowly and painfully than the Ukrainians. And if we see Gerasimov or whoever is behind this increasingly willing to come down hard on anyone who makes any kind of critique of what's going on, then it will only impede that learning process. So it is a weakening factor, but it's not a weakening factor in that it's going to lead to, I don't know, a colonel or a major pulling his troops out of the line and fleeing home or anything like that. It is just simply an example of the way that this military is essentially failing to be an effective learning organisation. It's having to fall back on simple techniques, which can be very, very effective. I mean, there was an excellent line. There was a really good thread from the American analyst Dara Massicot on this whole issue. I'll leave a link to it in the programme notes, in which she concludes that for all the issues of morale and leadership and political disunity, minds don't care about that. And precisely, the Russians are relying on mines and barbed wire and trenches and earthworks as well as all their sort of human panoply of warfare. And in that context then, yes, they can still hold the line. But on the other hand, it's harder and harder, and their chances of learning how to do it better are distinctly undermined. I mean, in this respect, one has to say, and it's certainly by no means the first time a Russian army has been in this position, they are extraordinarily badly served by their own leaders. And above all, I mean, although the fire gets concentrated on Shoigu and Gerasimov, this is, again, ultimately something that comes down onto Putin's doorstep. He is the commander-in-chief. He has made the crucial decisions about who will control his armed forces, what their priorities will be. He started this whole damn war. He is micromanaging the things that he shouldn't be micromanaging. And just as he failed to do with the whole Prigozhin-Shoigu spat, he is failing to step in on the real systemic challenges in which he is the only person who can fix them. So in this respect, I mean, this is interesting just simply in terms of what's going on in on the battlefield. But again, like so many other things, when it comes down to it, It's almost like the old mythology about the degree to which the health of the monarch was the health of the nation. Well, likewise, in this respect, you know, actually everything does ultimately come down to how is this system surviving, and above all, how a personalistic system operates when the person in charge is no longer able or willing to do their job. But my job is to stop now, and thank you very much, as ever, for listening. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/InMoscowShadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well.